I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're about to have a conversation with Dave Zirin once again, who, of course, is the man who is the behind the edge of sports. He is about to edit, coming out next week, a special edition of The Nation magazine, a sports edition that he'll be editing. His most recent book is Bad Sports, How Owners Are Ruining the Game We Love. And, of course, he wrote The People's History of Sports in the United States, Not Just a Game, Power, Politics, American Sports, and is one of our, I think, most important new sports thinkers and commentators in the country. And, Dave, welcome back to the program. Good to have you with us.
Oh, it's a privilege to be here, Mark. Thanks so much for having me.
So let's talk, first of all, about the top of the news, which is that you wrote about, which is the National Football League lockout is over and the end of the season averted. But I like your twist on it, because that's the cover story is that teams came together, the owners came together with the players and were able to meet in the middle and make a compromise. But you analytically see this a little differently.
I see it a lot differently, because I think if you were looking at who came off better in the deal, that might be a debate. I think the players did slightly better than the owners did once it was all said and done. But there's a bigger issue at stake here, and that's that at the start, the owners had a crippling advantage over the players at the start of this lockout. I mean, the owners were guaranteed $4 billion by the television networks, even if there was no football. They had a lockout slush fund that would have gotten them through the entire fall without having to worry about it. The owners also had what they believed to be a popular opinion on their side, because in past labor issues in sports, fans have tended to side pretty hard against players, saying, oh, well, they get paid for playing a game. What are they complaining about? And I feel like all of the owners' conventional wisdom, all of their conventional wisdom just went up in smoke. And the players, by taking it on politically and by standing together, that old expression, solidarity, the only way to win, by all 1,900 players standing together, I think that they were able to really extract a deal from ownership, which is much better than it could have been.
Now, let's parse some of these things out. I mean, one of the things that you even comment on your article and that many people say almost ad nauseum over and over again is that who cares? It's millionaires versus billionaires. We just want to watch the game. I mean, that's the common adage you hear on many sports shows and just people hanging out saying that. But
what I say to that is, is that I think it's a profound oversimplification, which I think actually a lot of fans broke from during this labor negotiation. Because it's not really billionaires versus millionaires. What it is in terms of NFL owners, it's almost three dozen of the wealthiest, most well-connected people in the United States going up against people who, on average, play their sport, in other words, apply their trade, for, on average, about 3.4 years, and then find themselves in their late 20s trying to figure out what they're going to do with the rest of their lives. You know, that's hardly an even playing field. And that's, I think, one of the great accomplishments of the players, because I think one of the other things that the owners thought they had in their back pocket was, well, these players, their shelf life is so short, then guess what? We're just going to, you know, hold out until they crack, because for a player to miss half a season, that would be the equivalent of a typical working person missing out on 12, 15 years of their earning life. I mean, that's what half a season is. So they thought they had that kind of advantage over the players themselves, but the players proved them wrong. And now at the end of it, what you have is the players have expanded health coverage. They have less practice time. That means less wear and tear. The end of the vaunted two-a-day practice, which can be very punishing on players' bodies. And in addition, the players, the owners get a slightly higher share of the overall revenue after this deal, but the actual pie itself, I think, is going to go up pretty dramatically in the years ahead, because they're due to sign new television contracts. So I don't think you're going to see a dip in players' salaries either.
So what do you think happened here? What made the difference here? I mean, because in the beginning, even you, as you wrote, and many people said, oh, the owners can't lose this. I mean, there's no way they're going to lose this battle. So, I mean, go ahead.
I think players were radicalized by issues of health and safety, and in a way that we've never seen before. Like, this wasn't a case of players just saying, hey, wait a minute, we want to keep our privileged lifestyle, and you're preventing us from doing it. I mean, I feel like this is just so much deeper than that. It just ran so much deeper than that. I feel like what you're looking at instead was an issue of players saying, well, wait a minute, the latest statistics show that we're going to die 20 years earlier than a typical American. This is something that's not good. Conditions of ALS, or otherwise known as Lou Gehrig's disease, being linked to concussions. And owners saying in the face of that, wow, we hear this data, we're going to put posters up in every locker room that explains the after effects of concussions. And oh, by the way, we want two extra games a season. And that, I think, had a radicalizing, I don't think this, I know it from talking to players, it really had a radicalizing effect. And that issue of the $4 billion slush fund that I described before, that had a radicalizing effect on players too, because what Judge David Doty, who, by the way, was a Reagan appointee, he ruled, he froze all of that money and said it was an unfair labor practice. And what was so interesting was talking to players after that is their interpretation of that was, wow, the owners actually left money, television money, on the table, money that should have been divided between players and bosses, because they wanted to have their own personal lockout slush fund. We can't trust them. And that belief that they couldn't trust the owners, that they didn't trust Roger Goodell, that they felt like the owners look at them as pieces of equipment, eminently disposable, well, that was just something that had a strong radicalizing effect on the typical player.
You have a quote that you, in one of your pieces you wrote, about the arrogance of, not the arrogance of ownership, the piece you wrote about, the arrogance of ownership. That NFL lockout goes into overtime. The quote, or what you said, that Troy Polamalu, the All-Pro safety for Pittsburgh, said, it's really kind of very important. I mean, I'll just read it and we can talk about this for a minute. He said, "I think what the players are fighting for is something bigger. A lot of people think it's millionaires versus billionaires, and that's a huge argument. The fact is, people fighting against big business. The big business argument is, I got money and I got the power, therefore I can tell you what to do. That's life everywhere. I think it's time when the football players are standing up and saying, no, 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 the people have the power." I mean, do you think that really extrapolates out into the larger society?
I'm a Baltimore Ravens fan, so you know it hurts me to say anything nice about Troy Polamalu, let alone any of the Pittsburgh Steelers. But that quote is really what it's all about. Players see what I think you see, Mark, and what I see, which is that these issues are very strongly connected, and they are connected. Like, if you look at what's happened over the last couple of years, Mark, this is the basics of it, is that the banks had a massive crisis. They were bailed out by the taxpayers, and now we've been left holding the bill. And to pay for bailing out the banks, you see all these attacks on teachers and public sector workers, and one of the ricochet effects of it has been that NFL and NBA owners are getting less public subsidies because there's less public money, and they're trying to get that profitability back on the backs of players and on the backs of fans, I might add, as well. And the players in the NFL really did stand up to that because they saw that their health and safety was being compromised in this process. That's what makes this an issue that transcends the sports page.
And I think that when you look at it that way, I mean, there's a larger picture going in here, just to take it to the edge of sports, so to speak, that has to do with our society and what's going on. If you look at what these guys are going through, granted, we talked about they make millions, but their time is short. Many of them, as we'll talk about John Mackey in a bit, become very ill young in their life because of the game they played. And guys making millions and billions off of their work. But this, in some ways that aren't always easy to connect, is connected to what happens in Wisconsin, what happens in New York with Cuomo, what's happening everywhere with state workers, with people who are doing the labor of our society. And that's a connection, a leap, I think, what you're arguing, partially has been made by some of the fans.
That's right. That's right. And I think fans did make that connection. I know players made that connection. Troy Polamalu's quote to me stands for that. And I think what the best part about that quote is Troy saying, hey, if it has to be NFL players, then it's going to be NFL players.
So, you know, but the same thing is going on in other realms of sports. We're seeing the same thing go on with the NBA now. There's a potential lockout there.
Yeah. And the NBA lockout's going to go much longer than the NFL one because there is a true crisis of profitability in the NBA right now. I mean, I would argue that the root of that crisis, though, is not what the NBA says, which is that salaries are too high. The root of the crisis is that the NBA does less revenue sharing than any other sport. Like, you know, the NFL splits the television money equally between all 32 teams. NFL owners were described as capitalists who act like socialists.
Right.
And it is true. But in the NBA, it's the opposite. So the Los Angeles Lakers, they're going to get, if the season went as planned, of course, they would get $300 million this year in television money alone. It would take a team like the Portland Trailblazers 15 years to get that much in television money. And they don't share the money. So it is true. Like, the NBA claims that 23 out of 30 teams lost money last year. Forbes magazine looked at that and said that's nonsense. But they did say that 17 out of 30 most likely lost money.
Mm-hmm.
But Forbes' analysis, unlike the NBA's own in-house analysis, says the league actually made money last year. It was profitable, and yet teams lose money because they don't share revenue. But the NBA, of course, is taking this crisis. You know, it's like almost like a Naomi Klein shock doctrine thing. Like, they're taking this crisis in profitability, and it is a crisis, and saying we need to do something radically different. And they want to make the radical difference be taking power out of the union and power out of the pocketbook of players. And I think this is something that we're seeing across the board in all aspects of our society. The difference in sports is that you actually have a platform where other people can hear what's going on. You know, so many of our labor battles in this country are in the shadows. Newspapers don't have labor departments or someone who works the labor beat anymore.
Absolutely.
And sports becomes a place for these issues to be writ large.
So in a larger sense, I mean, we have the teams in this country have been owned by individuals and corporately owned for a long time. This is not a new phenomenon in sports in this country, especially in football, baseball, basketball. But so it makes it also hard for people sometimes to relate to because of that, because it's as we said earlier, it's a billionaire thing that are in people's minds about these athletes and these owners. But I wonder what kind of discussion you need to have to begin to alter that conversation, to make a different kind of conversation. You know, I mean, like, people get extremely angry sometimes about the public dollars going into the Orioles stadium, the Ravens stadium, anybody's stadium around the country.
Mm.
And so, I mean, what changes that discourse? What are the things you think this discourse is missing?
You know, this is a very interesting question you ask, and I think one of the things we have to do is make fans more of an active participant in these discussions and these processes. And fans have every right to have a seat at the table. Like, take the NFL as an example. 31 of the 32 NFL stadiums receive public money. 19 of those 32 stadiums receive at least 70% of their money entirely from public subsidies. Now take it to us here. Take it to us, the fan. We're also the people who have been sold this bill of goods, that, and you know this in Baltimore very well, that says that stadiums are going to become a substitute for anything resembling urban planning.
Right.
So people depend on stadiums as a kind of panacea in an era in many cities of deindustrialization and the loss of union jobs. So they sold us that bill of goods. They sold that to us. And so we have the right to say, okay, you can't just have a lockout because you're disagreeing about how to split a multi-billion-dollar pie. Fans actually have the right to say how some of this money gets allocated. And when you look at it, it's like, look, we can have sports without owners. You can't have sports without players. And you can't have sports without teams. But it's the owners in this process who, frankly, are superfluous. And that's a place where I think that's an empowering place for the discussion to go. Like, if you could have a fan-owned team in Green Bay, Wisconsin, there's no reason why you can't have one in Baltimore, Maryland.
You know, that one point about Green Bay, I mean, just for a second to digress and come back to the players kind of really coming out on top, as you put it, in this battle with the NFL owners. How Green Bay works and why it works. Go ahead.
Yeah, people do ask me sometimes who's the best owner in sports, and I always say it's the 112,000 owners of the Green Bay Packers. The Packers, since the 1920s, have been a fan-owned team. And one of the things that means is, well, first of all, ticket prices are much lower. Beer costs much less, 50% less than a typical stadium.
That's a selling point.
But at the same time, what it also means is that a huge percentage of concessions go directly into local charities in Green Bay itself. And so instead of becoming an institution of exploitation, it actually is a buoy for the community there. And to me, it's a much more forward-thinking way to think about how we're going to keep our city solvent until we figure out how we're going to get decent jobs back in this country, if we ever get them back in this country, than to say, like the current approach, which is like this Ayn Rand dystopia of owners who take public money out of our pockets and magically watch as it turns into private money and then use the stadiums themselves as a kind of real estate scam to borrow money out and reinvest it and eventually bankrupt the teams, which is what we've seen in Los Angeles with the Dodgers and in New York with the Mets. That's the vision that they're planning for sports. Mm. So some of this is about better urban policy, but it's also about saving sports from the owners themselves.
And I'd like to tie something in that you wrote about just a little bit ago when John Mackey's passing.
Yeah.
One of the great players of all time, a really incredibly lovely human being, really, really bright. I had the pleasure to know him just a little bit back in the day. And you wrote what few people wrote about in terms of what his passing meant and who he was and how that legacy in many ways ties into where we are now and to what this negotiation was.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Mackey was nicknamed when he was a player for the Baltimore Colts. He was nicknamed the smartest guy in the room. And he earned that. He was the first president of the first ever NFL Players Association. He brought together players from the recently defunct AFL when they came into the NFL to form the one mega league in the late 1960s. He led the first ever NFL players strike, which resulted in $11 million, which was a lot of money back then, going into health and safety as well as increased salaries. And then he put his name forward on a lawsuit to knock down what was called the Roselle Rule, which restricted the right of player movement. He did all of these things, And it's a remarkable accomplishment in and of itself. And so if that had been John Mackey's life, you know, known for being the first president of the NFLPA as well as being the greatest tight end, arguably, in NFL history, that would be enough. But, of course, John Mackey will also be remembered for being perhaps the most visible sufferer of the after effects of playing in the NFL, suffering from frontotemporal dementia. And it's a terrible, very, very sad story. I mean, his wife, Sylvia, they were living in California, and they moved back to Baltimore because she knew that if he got lost in Baltimore, which happened often, the smartest guy in the room was forgetting where he lived, walking in the streets of Baltimore, he knew that people in Baltimore would take care of him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's remarkable how many stories that I've heard, they're really interesting stories, frankly, of people who see John Mackey and knew him and made sure that he had somewhere safe to be until Sylvia Mackey or someone else in the family was able to find him. And it really is so tragic, and frankly, it raises issues about the barbarism of football and bigger questions about the ethical nature of the existence of this sport. But it definitely, for him to die right in the middle of these negotiations after suffering for 20 years with this horrible affliction, I know from talking to people in the NFLPA that it raised issues for them about the importance of standing strong for the next generation.
Well, there's no question. When you talked about the barbarity of games like football, now, I mean, it's coming to the fore now at last about how severe the injuries are that football players get on the field and also suffer from after their career is over in National Football League work. But there are a lot of people who would argue and say, well, look, if you take that out of the game, there is no game. There is no fun. There is no sport to watch. There is no macho game to play if you take that out of the equation.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing because one of the things that the NFLPA won was the end of these things called two-a-day practices. And they collectively bargained that out of the NFL team's practice schedule. And the two-a-day has always been a kind of mythical part of what it means to be in the National Football League. Like this idea that you practice in pads twice in a day, you do these repetitive hit drills over and over and over again. And it's this idea that says, you know, the more you get hit, the tougher you'll be. You know, you're conditioning your body set for violence. And, you know, it's kind of like back in the day when Bear Bryant was coaching at Kentucky and he denied his players water, saying it would make them more able to withstand dehydration if he didn't give them water in practice. In other words, it's macho bull spit, for lack of a better term. It's a bunch of macho bull spit. And the fact of the matter is, being hit a lot does not condition you for violence. All it does is condition you to get hurt. Especially on your brain. Now, the best way to not get hurt is to not get hit. And the best thing that could have happened to players is getting two-a-days collectively bargained out. Now, some have pointed out that this is actually in the interest of owners as well, because since they do view players as property, you want to keep your equipment healthy, which then this would certainly do that. But on the flip side of that, Mark, it just tells you something about the mentality that follows the sport as well.
Mm-hmm.
That a prerequisite to playing football is basically conditioning your body for violence. I keep thinking this horrible story of a guy who's in the Hall of Fame, a former offensive lineman named John Hanna, and about how his wife found him after his playing career in the garage just running as hard as he could into his garage door over and over again. Because his body had become almost addicted to the violence itself.
Mm. Yeah. It's almost like post-traumatic stress disorder coming out of war.
Yeah.
In a sense.
It's not the worst comparison. I mean, people, of course, compare war and football all the time. Sometimes really stupidly. You know, like the quarterback is a field general throwing bullets and bombs and all that nonsense. But this is one of those cases where I actually do think that there's a real connection, this hyper-masculinist approach to violence that is somehow purifying as part of the ethos of both operations.
Let me ask this question before we run out of time. The Sun today reported the Ravens are cutting four major players, veterans off the team, that they say make room for their salary cap. What relation does that have to this NFL bargain and deal that was made, and could we be seeing that across the country, and what does it really mean?
No, it's not going to be seen across the country because there are only a few teams that are over the cap right now. Actually, a lot of the teams are far under the cap, like the Redskins of all teams, which are known as free spending teams, are under the salary cap and they have money to spend. The Ravens are releasing major players. They're releasing Willis McGahee, Kelly Gregg, Derek Mason, and Todd Heap. Now, those are some fan favorites in there. But I fully expect, and all the sort of experts fully expect, Ozzie Newsome, the general manager of the Ravens, to try to re-sign, at the very least, Heap and Mason. But the idea is you release them to get under the cap, and then you try to sign them at a lower cost. And that's what the Ravens are in a position of having to do. And there will be some teams that have to do this, but it's only going to be a couple.
So now, before we run out of here, man, tell us a little bit of a tease, if you can, about the upcoming Nation magazine that you're editing. It'll be an issue devoted to sports. What's up?
I can't wait for this. Next week. It's an all-sports issue of the Nation magazine. People might know the Nation. It's a liberal weekly magazine. It's the oldest weekly magazine in the United States since 1860. And in all those years, this is just the second sports issue they've ever done. And I got to guest edit it, and we got a great mix of athletes, activists, authors, and academics. It's a critique of sports. It's also a huge celebration of sports. And there'll be online features at thenation.com, or people can pick it up at their local newsstand. It's the Nation magazine. It's the sports issue. It's out next week.
Well, we'll look forward to that. I'm going to look forward to talking when that comes out. You can hear Edge of Sports and Dave Zirin. If you don't have it locally, what you can do is he's on Edge of Sports at Sirius XM Radio Satellite, Channel 125 and XM 241, Friday at noon Eastern Time. And you can also go to iTunes and check in and download him there and have him on your iPhone or whatever it is you run around with. Of course, he wrote the incredible People's History of Sports in the United States and much more, and joins us here often. Dave Zirin, thank you so much, my friend. Good to have you with us.
Oh, my privilege, Mark. Anytime.
Take care, brother.
You too.
And stay with us, folks. When we come back, we'll be joined by Robert Creamer from Democracy Partners and Charles Lollard from Americans for Prosperity to debate and argue the debt and deficit debate taking place in Congress today. Don't go away. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com.